Session number 10112, reel 1.
Mr. Thompson, reel 1. Can you tell me how you came to be involved with the Mau Mau emergency in the first place, Mr. Thompson?
Towards the end of the war, I was posted to the East African Artillery, stationed in Kenya, which led to my interest in Africans, East Africans. And when the time came to take my discharge, I decided to stay overseas. I was very lucky because I obtained a job almost immediately, a temporary one, as a civil reabsorption officer with the Kenya government. That was a job which was to assist African soldiers to re-establish themselves at home, to make best use of their discharge monies and so on. And my posting was to a district called Fort Hall.
Could I just interrupt you there and ask you a little bit about that work with getting askaris back into civilian life and what the problems were?
The problems, really, the main one, was to try and persuade them to make good use of the money they had in hand. It was a great temptation for them to buy second-hand lorries or set up in businesses for which they had insufficient capital. We tried to persuade them, in a sense, to form up to form small cooperative groups. A number of them, of course, had been overseas to Burma and Ceylon, where they'd seen a new world, and they were finding it a little bit hard to settle down again into rather dark, sometimes dank huts on distant hillsides, and they wanted to keep in touch with news. They wouldn't put it like that at the time, but having had a taste of the wider world, they wanted to have a voice in it, I think. There was also a desire of the government to see these people settled as peacefully as possible, I think perhaps because the Kenya government thought that they might have learned one or two undesirable things when overseas. That in a political sense, having to express themselves politically. If you've been an African in a bush situation, probably only wearing a loincloth, you're taken into the army, you're polished up, fed up, taken overseas, where you see all sorts of things, and people with riches unimagined, it's not easy to come home and settle down again. There must be some sort of, for want of a term, political infiltration there. Something goes into the brain which sticks. Which eventually, I think, led to quite a lot of what happened during Mau Mau.
Can you give some specific examples of that type of influence?
I'll quote one man. A man I knew very well. His name was Julius Ngugi Ndugi, who had been a corporal with the KR in Burma. And he had for a long time been stationed at a depot just over the border in India, where he had met some Sikhs who were not at all fond of the British. It so happened that this man became my clerk, and he was a very difficult man to deal with. He was an excellent clerk, and I liked him very much. But as time went on, in his conversations, he revealed to me a sense of, all isn't quite well. I've seen another side of the white Bwana. That, I think, is a specific. I can nail that down to one man, and that's probably as good an example as I can give you.
What side of the white Bwana did he feel that he didn't like?
Perhaps that the white man wasn't paying enough, wasn't giving enough. He had seen overseas successful Asians who were doing much better than his own African people at home.
So
he wanted a slice of the cake, to use our modern terminology.
So expectations had been
expectations,
aroused.
Yes.
What particular tribe had he come from?
The Kikuyu.
Do you think there's any significance in that?
There is no significance in the sense that it helped to create Mau Mau, but it's rather like putting flavouring in a dish, or the sultanas in a cake. It helped towards the eventual Mau Mau pudding, for want of another term.
Did you think that his point of view was reasonable or unreasonable when he came out with this type of thing?
I thought he was reasonable. I still think so. More so now, with the advantage of hindsight. But even then, I thought it was reasonable. I had come out of the army, where I'd thoroughly enjoyed working with these young African soldiers. And I think I was a little bit disappointed when I saw what their home life was like. And chaps I'd known, a good bombardier, a good African sergeant, I suppose in my heart I wished them well. I knew they could do well in the forces. Why shouldn't they do well outside? I, like them, was but young and unformed, but I did have a feeling for it, yes, for them.
Was this particular chap unusual in having been influenced by his Asian experience in that way?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. There were several ex-soldiers whose life had been altered by going overseas. Just as in this country here. But more so there, because they'd been taken out of one environment into something totally different. To countries they never even knew existed.
And it was this type of influence, was it?
Yes, yes.
Sorry, I interrupted your story with you mentioning Fort Hall.
Well, I went to Fort Hall, and in fact there weren't a great number of Kikuyu to be reabsorbed. They were not one of the greater suppliers of African soldiers. And by the time I arrived there, quite a few had already returned home and disappeared into the countryside. I was very fortunate in having a most excellent district commissioner, Kikuyu speaker, Walter Coutts, who said to me, "Don't hang about just being a young ex-soldier. I think you ought to learn something about this life out here. And don't think you can sit in an office at Fort Hall and get these ex-soldiers to come to you. You must go out to them. You must go out to their villages. And the very first thing I want you to do, Thompson, is to go out and spend a fortnight with a gentleman called Senior Chief Njiri, who has many wives. You should go to his village and stay there with him." "But I don't speak Kikuyu," I said. I'd already appreciated that the Kiswahili I'd learned in the army was not the Kiswahili that was necessary, was adequate for the job I was beginning to do. He said, "That doesn't matter. These people are wise. Chief Njiri is particularly so. Now, if you go up there, you'll get another view." And so I really started off by being pushed out into the right high up into the district, far from any roads, almost onto the forest edge at about 7,400 feet, into a village where I stayed a fortnight. And that opened my eyes. I travelled around the district on foot and in a very old vehicle which had been provided for me, checking up on as many of these ex-soldiers as I possibly could. And I found that they wanted something. In the army, they'd had the weekly ration of film, sport, all the other things. These were missing in their life. And I found myself organising football matches, trying to get hold of film strips, borrow a film projector, and so on. And again, coming back to Walter Coutts, the district commissioner, he said, "We're short-handed." Now, at that time, I think the population of Fort Hall District was about 200,000. I may be wide of the mark there, but 200,000. There was one district commissioner, one district officer, one very junior district officer, only just appointed, ex-forces, one doctor, one nursing sister, one agricultural officer. And they looked after what was the equivalent of an English county. So the district commissioner was very short-handed. And he started to drag me in, as it were. When you go up there, will you do a pay safari? Will you pay the chiefs and headmen? Will you check on... The doctor wanted me to check on the dispensaries. There were 15 dispensaries all over the district. Would I see that the dispensaries were clean? Would I see the check-up that they had enough aspirin? All the other little things. And so I became embroiled in the basic administration. And I loved it. And gradually, as it were, the reabsorption side fell away and I started to lead a new life, a sort of half district officer, half welfare officer. Now, there are other reabsorption officers in Kenya having the same experiences. And eventually it was decided by the Kenya government that they should turn us into community development officers. Now, this was a very odd job indeed, because it was a job set up by the Kenya government under pressure from Britain to do something about African welfare, but we were not members of the colonial administration. We were out on a fringe. I was lucky because of the district commissioner I had, who said, you can't be out on the edge of things. You have to be within things. Now, just about this same time, we had the first series of riots in Fort Hall District, which we later learned were part of Mau Mau. And these were women's riots. The women ostensibly complaining about having to dig bench terraces, what in Kikuyu called mitaros. Very hilly, very mountainous countryside. The land was being eroded, and so these terraces had to be constructed. The government had given powers to local African district councils, they were then known as local native councils, to pass bylaws enforcing people to go out and dig these mitaros, these bench terraces, one day in every week. Well, digging with a hoe under the hot sun is never popular. It's even less popular when it's enforced. But it's even less popular than that when the people who really do the agricultural work in a society are the women, and the men stand on and look. So the women hated these bench terraces and the work connected with them. But they were being whipped up by agitators. And the first sea riots that took place in Fort Hall District were in widely separated places. Women only appeared, and they had travelled in from many other parts of the district, which meant that they'd been organised. On one of the worst of these riots, they overturned the district commissioner's car, they set fire to a building. No one was killed or injured, although the agricultural officer was chased through the government headquarters by a mob of shrieking women. We sort of laughed about it at the time, but we were beginning to get worried.
Did they catch him?
No. And gradually, I turned from being a welfare community development officer into very much more of a district officer. I still wasn't a member of the administration, though. I was still only a locally employed officer. And
sorry, could I just interrupt you there about these riots? Did you actually witness them yourself?
Yes.
What did you actually see yourself?
I have a clear memory only of one, and that took place on a Sunday. I think it would be in about October 1948, where great files of women, all singing in a high-pitched Kikuyu voice, entered the district headquarters. Now, when I'm talking about district headquarters, I'm talking about the area of the district headquarters, what in East Africa we used to call the Boma, Burma comes from Swahili, from a thorn hedge. Thorn hedges had originally been the early headquarters. And there were, I should think, 500 or 600 of them, all jumping up and down and chanting and shrieking, "We will not dig Mitaros." The district commissioner, addressed them in Kikuyu. I said he was an excellent Kikuyu speaker. And the line he took was, "Now, you mustn't, you really must think." Now, let me digress. You have to understand that these were illiterate women. Many people don't understand that Kenya, the east coast of Africa, is unlike the west coast, which had been in touch with white man for very many years. The very district of Fort Hall wasn't started until about 1880, 1886, I think. And we're talking about 1948, so it's only over 50 years of white occupation. And although education had built up, you can see that over 50 years it wouldn't have bitten largely into the female population, as it were. So we're talking about women, as it were, speaking from the illiterate heart. He spoke to them and said, "You must look, just look down there." I remember his words. "Just look down there at the Mathioya River. It's running red with Kikuyu soil." He said, "Do you want your land down in Mombasa? Surely it's worth some toil." Sounds a bit sort of like verse, but this was what he said, and he tried to put it over to them, but they were in no mood to listen. And eventually half of this crowd broke away and ran through the Boma, through the main road of the Boma, where they met the district commissioner's wife, Mrs. Coots, who was driving in the district commissioner's old Ford box-body car. And she realised these women were in an angry mood, jumped out of it, and they turned the car over. And she escaped into a nearby house.
Pursued?
No, not pursued. Things weren't like that at the time. There was still a great deal of respect. But a lot of women went out standing by the hedge waving their fists and making this sort of chilling sound which Kikuyu women do. That was the first one which I remember. But one thing we knew and we had direct evidence for was that had been whipped up by one or two local gentlemen who were members of the Kikuyu Central Association, which was the nub of what was to become known as Mau Mau.
What other one did you see?
I saw one at a place called Saba Saba. That also was on a Sunday. And I remember, all I can remember of that is a sort of vast throng of women milling about on a dusty hillside. Can't tell you any more than that now.
What was the direct evidence you had about the instigators?
We had a... Oh, I forget his name now. We had a local preacher, Kikuyu preacher, who occupied the pulpit of a church which was only a couple of miles outside the district headquarters. And the local chief and headman had been reporting that over the last few months, his sermons from the pulpit had become more and more political, and that he was getting at the women. The evidence came through the chief and through the headman, but they were good people, and a lot of the elders of the tribe were getting very disturbed at the activities of younger people, including some of the ex-soldiers I've mentioned, and they would come along to Walter Coots and say to him, "Look, Bwana, things are not right." The older conservative, they don't like life to be upset. They don't want too many worries. And there was a constant flow of information which made it absolutely certain that these women's rights had been organised.
So it was men who were instigating women?
Oh, yes. As far as I can remember at that stage, we had no women politicians of note. Some emerged later on, but not then.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
Well, as I said, I was doing this sort of double job. Now, one thing I'd become very interested in during my time was native law and custom. I was most interested in tribal law, tribal custom, how it worked, what it did, how it influenced the tribe, the secrecy of oaths. Kikuyu society was actually based on a series of oaths. I'll deal with this later. But they were people who loved secrecy, and everything had to be done according to customary rote. And I was getting more and more interested in this. But as time went on, and I've jumped now from about 1948 to beginnings of 1950. We'd had several changes of district officer, and I was beginning to be one of the people who knew as much about the geography of the district and the people within it and the chiefs as headmen as anyone else. And I was given extra duties, which I lapped up. I wasn't awfully fond of just sort of putting over film shows and film strips. I felt that more could be done by educating African members of the staff to put it over to their own people. And I was given magisterial powers, junior ones, powers of a third-class magistrate, so that I could hear cases in the court, very minor ones, drunkenness, the odd fight, this sort of thing, but at the same time, I could begin to hear appeals from the African, the native courts. And this was unusual, that anyone who is not a district officer should have these powers. I can't think of anyone else who had them. There may have been, but I'm relying here on distant memory. But in 1952, when things were really hotting up in terms of Mau Mau, I was given enhanced magisterial powers and created a temporary district officer, which led to my later heavier involvement with Mau Mau. Later on, in 1955, I actually became a full member of the colonial administration. Luckily for me, my service was backdated. But I was becoming more and more involved. Now, because I'd been a civil reabsorption officer, because I'd been a welfare officer, community development officer, and a sort of assistant district officer, I'd now been in the district at the outbreak of the emergency or outbreak of real Mau Mau. I'd been in the district 4 years. The district commissioner had changed. Every district officer who'd been there had changed. And so I was a person with a considerable amount of knowledge, and I was becoming more and more useful. Which led to when the state of emergency was declared and it was decided that it would be impossible to administer a district fully and to cope with Mau Mau from district headquarters alone, which in Fort Hall was situated on the northern edge of the district, it was decided to divide it into 4 divisions. And I became district officer in charge of the most southerly division, which is known as Kandara Division, which bordered onto the European farming area of Thika and another Kikuyu district of Kiambu, as divided by the Thika River. And so I had the Fort Hall district was divided into 15 separate locations. Each location had a chief. Under each chief were a certain number of headmen. A chief, incidentally, and this is vital to one's understanding, I think, of our administration, in Kenya, a chief was not, as so many people envisage, an hereditary figure. He was not. In Kenya, chiefs were selected by the district commissioner to be a member of his staff. You had the district commissioner in charge, under the district commissioner, a or some district officers, and under them a chief who, as it were, administered each location, and under the chief, headman. They were another rung down in the administrative ladder. They were not hereditary. And they were, in fact, appointed on a sort of electoral system. Again, I think it's worth telling you this. What would happen if it was necessary to find a chief, a new chief for an area, and I will give you an exact example. This was the appointment of a chief for location number 4 of Kandara Division. We held a barasa, that's a meeting of the local people, and we said the time has come to select a new chief. In this case, the old chief had resigned, he'd retired, he got a bit ancient, long in the tooth. Now, the district commissioner wants to know who you would like for your chief. He is going to be here in a fortnight's time, and any candidates you have should present themselves. On that occasion, 5 people presented themselves. One was totally unacceptable. He was a known drunk. He had... I'm sorry, I have to clear my throat. Yes, let's go again. One was immediately discarded because he had a prison record, he'd been a goat thief, he was a known drunk. Now, the people accepted that. They knew that Bwana District Commissioner couldn't have a chap like that to be the chief. That left 4. One was a school teacher, can't remember his name now. Another was an elder named Ngugi. Ngugi Mwai. Then there was another man, Ndungu, someone or other, who I think was a market trader. And another figure, Paulo Mungai. Now, Paulo Mungai was a very important man in a way because he was known to be associated with the Kikuyu Central Association. He was a politician and a very skillful one in his way at the local level. Now, the district commissioner said to the people, I will take these 4 candidates, now you may vote. Well, of course, it wasn't a secret ballot. What they did was they lined up behind their candidate. And it went something like this. One man had probably only 6 standing behind him. Another 50, 60 standing behind him. Another had about 100. But this man, Paulo Mungai, had 400 or 500 standing behind him. Now, the district commissioner here was presented with almost a fait accompli because this man was the choice of the people. But in fact, the district commissioner didn't really want him because of his political background. Could he trust him as a chief? Well, we had an excellent district commissioner, one Francis Lloyd, at that time, who worked on the basis of better the devil you know. And he accepted the people's choice of Paulo Mungai. And it so happened that Paulo Mungai, who had been involved in the early stages of the Kikuyu Central Association and knew quite a lot about Mau Mau, in the end really came over to our side and not only made an extremely good chief, but a very good fighter.